Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics.
The timeout's over. Mr. Polyev now will have to have his members come here and vote for as long as it takes.
The government vows hours of voting on a sustainable jobs bill as the opposition parties team up to demand a first minister's meeting on carbon pricing. We'll hear from the energy minister, Jonathan Wilkinson.
We recognize that Canada today needs our government to invest.
The finance minister says next week's budget will keep Canada on a strong fiscal path. Two economists tell us what they'll be looking for in those numbers. And that budget will include a federal push to take British Columbia's housing policies nationwide. We hear more about the BC Builds program from the BC Minister for Housing. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, I'm Andrew Thompson, in for Michael Serapio. MPs could face hours of voting on the government's sustainable jobs bill, with Liberals pushing for individual votes on scores of conservative amendments and pledging to be in the House as long as it takes on Bill C-50, a bill requiring the government to provide a net zero jobs plan every 5 years. This comes with the official opposition continuing to demand a televised first minister's meeting on carbon pricing.
Yesterday, this House passed a conservative common sense motion calling on him to convene an emergency televised carbon tax meeting with all 14 premiers. The Prime Minister is hiding, but maybe someone over there can tell us what day will the televised carbon tax meeting be?
The Honourable Government House Leader.
Speaker, today we are debating Bill C-50, the Sustainable Jobs Act, which the Royal Bank of Canada says there are 400,000 of to come to Canadians if we were just to unlock the kind of prosperity envisaged in this very progressive piece of legislation. Instead, the Conservatives put forward 20,000 amendments generated by artificial intelligence. The robo-caucus needs to stop its robo-work with its robo-amendments and stop gatekeeping the opportunities that are coming to Canadians.
And with me now is Jonathan Wilkinson, the Federal Minister of Energy and Natural Resources. Minister, I want to start with Bill C-50 and what the Conservatives are saying about why they're opposing this bill, why they're taking, you know, the action they're taking. They're claiming, you know, this is going to lead to the loss of about 170,000 direct Canadian jobs. It's going to displace another 450,000 direct and indirect jobs, that this is a what they call a top-down central planning approach that's targeting the destruction of the oil and gas sector. You know, you've obviously been arguing against this today in the House of Commons. You know, why do you believe you're right in your approach, and why do you think they're wrong?
Well, I think the Conservative approach has been, to be honest, pretty hard to understand. It is so over the top, it is almost unbelievable. So this bill is actually about setting up a framework. I wonder if my Conservative colleagues have actually even read the bill. It's 11 pages long. The major thing that it actually does is it sets up a council that will be comprised of labor, Indigenous organizations, industry, and environmental organizations to provide recommendations to the government about how we actually grow a clean economy going forward. It builds on work that we've been doing across the country, and very much including Alberta and the oil and gas sector. It includes things like, you know, the $4 billion that Air Products is putting up to build a hydrogen plant that uses natural gas, and the $12 billion investment that Dow Chemical is putting in place in Alberta to build the world's first net zero petrochemical facility. So this is about building an economy that's going to be strong in what necessarily must be a lower carbon future. If one believes the science of climate change, and I would say, you know, 99.99% of climate scientists agree, then you need to actually be thinking about the economic side of the equation, and that's what this does.
I do want to ask about your ultimate timeline for getting this bill through Parliament and into law, because given what we've seen so far in the House and at committee with opposition, what's your sense of the timeline for getting this bill passed into law. And then I do also want to ask you about the actual timeline for these measures coming into effect, because, of course, you know, there have been amendments on the actual coming into force date for this bill.
Yeah, so certainly, I mean, it's been a struggle. The bill has been for the House now for a little bit less than a year, in large measure because of obstruction from the Conservative Party. I mean, when it was in committee, they had a AI-induced sort of robo-amendment process where they proposed 20,000 different amendments to an 11-page bill. I mean, it gets to the point where this is kind of legislative vandalism. It's not reasonable sort of behavior in the House of Commons. But I would say in terms of getting the bill through, we are hopeful to get it through the House of Commons quite expeditiously. But it, of course, has to go to the Senate, which will want to study the bill. But, you know, my intention is to try to move this along as quickly as possible, understanding that the Senate will want to have their own appropriate look at it. And that's why Parliament should work. And then to actually move this into force, one of the first things that we will be required to do under this bill is to bring forward an action plan, a final action plan in 2024. We've released an interim action plan last year, and that's available publicly. But we've said that we will be required to bring forward an action plan, and governments going forward will be required to bring forward action plans every 5 years. And part of what this bill does is create transparency mechanisms to force governments to be able to be transparent with people about the work that they are doing to ensure that they're growing an economy that can be strong in a low carbon future.
Okay, I want to turn to carbon pricing now, because we've heard the NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, say that the current federal plan is putting too much of a burden on people and not enough on big polluters. You know, does he have a point? Because your government has talked a lot, obviously, about affordability challenges that Canadians are facing right now.
Well, absolutely, affordability needs to be top of mind for everybody. But, you know, I would say I haven't seen Mr. Singh's specific comments. I'd be more than happy to sit with Mr. Singh and have a conversation and to explain how the industrial pricing system works. There is an industrial pricing system in Canada. It does require that large polluters pay, and that is very important. I mean, that's part of the pricing mechanism is to incent large polluters to actually pollute less. The consumer price is a different mechanism, and it is focused on ensuring that we're creating incentives to people to make more efficient choices. But on the consumer side, it's built in a way that actually does address affordability. I mean, 200 economists wrote a letter just 2 weeks ago that actually demonstrated that it's the most efficient way to reduce carbon emissions, and it does it in a manner where 8 out of 10 Canadian families get more money back, and the people who actually end up paying more than they get back are people who have a 6,000 square foot house, a Hummer in their front drive, and a boat in the backyard. And, you know, at the end of the day, those are the folks that are polluting the most. They should pay more.
So are those the kind of arguments then that, you know, your government would be willing to put up at a first minister's meeting on carbon pricing? We know that motion passed yesterday with Bloc and NDP support. We've seen several premiers suggesting it. We've even seen a former environment minister in your government, Catherine McKenna, say she's supportive of the idea. Do you think that meeting should happen?
Well, let me say, first of all, at the beginning of this process back in 2016, there was a meeting of the first ministers during the development of the Pan-Canadian framework. And all of the ministers, with the exception of one at the time, signed on to a plan that included carbon pricing. I would say that certainly we're not ruling it off the table. But before you get into a position where you're demanding a meeting, yeah, I think it's incumbent on the premiers to actually come up with some alternatives. And that's particularly true for premiers who have no climate plans. Like, look, Premier Moe in Saskatchewan has no climate plan. He has no targets between now and 2030. He has no targets between now and 2050. He has no detailed actions as to how he's going to reduce emissions. The same could be said to be true in Alberta and in New Brunswick. So at the end of the day, folks actually have to come up with reasonable alternatives about how you're fighting climate change. Unless you're like Premier Moe, who said, you know, carbon pricing is more, they looked at every other option. They were all more expensive than carbon pricing, but he doesn't want to do carbon pricing. So the implication is he's not going to do anything to fight climate change. Well, I mean, I'm not sure there's a real good basis for a conversation there. But if they actually want to come forward with plans that actually show how they're going to make progress, that include some kind of pricing mechanism, of course, we're open to those conversations. We talk to the provinces pretty much every week about these kinds of issues.
All right, Minister Jonathan Wilkinson, we have to leave it there. Thanks for your time on this.
All right, thank you.
We are now 5 days away from the federal budget. You'll find complete coverage right here on CPAC next Tuesday. The government has already promised billions of dollars in new measures, from housing to defense to AI. Today, the finance minister saying that does not mean the deficit will increase.
Your government has pledged a lot of new spending announcements in recent days ahead of the budget. You know, what does this mean for the deficit? And what does this mean for fiscal, you know, restraint from your government? Will we see the deficit grow?
No. I'm happy to give a longer answer to you. So when we first formed government in 2015, we were elected on a commitment to make the necessary investments in Canada and Canadians and to do it in a fiscally responsible way. That continues to be our approach today.
All right, well, let's talk about what to look for in the numbers when the federal budget comes next week. Peter Rantunesh is chief economist for the Conference Board of Canada. Mostafa Askari is chief economist for the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy. Welcome to you both. Now, we heard the finance minister telling reporters today that no, the deficit is not going up. She's repeating her message that the government is on a fiscally sustainable path, that the government is committed to the fiscal guideposts that it laid out last year. Now, Pedro, when you open up that budget document next week and you actually start to parse the numbers, the hard data, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, I'm actually a little surprised that we're not going to be adding to the deficit. Perhaps there's a little bit more fiscal room to maneuver on the revenue side. Perhaps there's some surprises there. But we've certainly seen a lot of money announced, a lot of it within the next 5 years, within the five-year planning timeline of the budget. So, where are the revenues coming up to kind of match those additional expenditures? And I think if we are going to keep to those guideposts, we are still in a situation where we're running deficits, when the economy really is at full employment. And, we would certainly urge that we ease up on the spending, here at this point.
Okay, Mostafa, let me get your thoughts on that, on what you're going to be looking for in terms of revenue, expenses, and what the government's overall fiscal health is here.
Yeah, I think having a sort of a fixed deficit not changing could be done through different ways. Whether they're going to raise revenues or not, we don't really know. And if they are going to raise revenues, in which part of revenues, and they're saying that they're not going to raise middle taxes, but then it could be a high tax increases, it could be wealth tax, could be anything else, that we will be looking for that. And the other part of this is that not a lot of people actually talk about this, is the deficit itself is not as important as the primary balance. No, not a lot of people talk about the primary balance, which is revenues minus program spending, excluding the debt charges, because that really has importance for their actually guidepost, the debt to GDP ratio, which is their targeting. And if you have a primary surplus, that makes it much easier to actually deal with that and seeing a debt to GDP ratio coming down.
And, again, as you mentioned, Peter, we've already seen billions of dollars promised over the last couple of weeks, housing, AI innovation, defense, affordability. When you're actually looking at the numbers in the budget on some of that spending that's already announced, what are you looking for in terms of how that spending gets broken down?
Well, it's how it's broken down. I think obviously there's a big focus on housing and affordability. These are important issues, but again, what are the what are going to be the constraints on the economy side? Do we have the workers and et cetera to kind of match those initiatives? But what am I going to look for? I think it's the timing of a lot of these measures. We know a lot of the defense measures are spanning over 20 years. I suspect they'll be tail end loaded. We won't see a whole lot of spending up front. And that's maybe the plan that the government has to keep the deficit in line with kind of previous announcements, in line with their targets.
Right. And Mostafa, we have seen provincial governments tabling their budgets so far this year. And, they've been accounting for inflation and interest rates and lower revenue projections. So there's been a lowering of a fiscal outlook, but there still is this desire to spend on cost of living measures, for instance. Mm-hmm. So should we expect more of the same when we see that federal document?
I think they will have something for cost of living. They definitely, I mean, they have been talking about this. On the other measures that they have announced, I think one has to be careful, as was mentioned. If it is their capital spending for defense, those things have to be amortized over a long period of time, so they won't affect the current deficit. If there are loans, the loans don't, they go on the balance sheet. They're not spending right away unless there is a default on the loans, which will happen in the future. So those kind of things we have to sort of look at and see exactly how those things are planned, and whether it's a capital spending, whether it's the current spending in the next couple of years, and those things will affect the profile for the bottom line.
Now, Pedro, one issue that's been getting a lot of attention is productivity. We've heard economists talk about it. We've heard the Bank of Canada talk about it, that it's resembling a national emergency, especially compared to what's happening in the American economy. So what should we expect on that front in the budget?
Well, I hope it's more of an issue around what we shouldn't see, or what we're hoping not to see. And, you know, if we go back to that speech that the deputy governor made, I mean, the number one issue was the amount of physical capital, in other words, the amount of investment that we're seeing by the private sector. If we go to one of the bigger challenges around that, why are we not attracting private investment? Is because we're no longer competitive on corporate taxes. So I think we have to be very careful around what we do on corporate taxes, not to have that unwanted or undesired effect on investment. Our investment is a laggard in comparison to other jurisdictions. So I think that's, to me, the easiest piece that we can address in terms of making ourselves more competitive to private investment, to address that productivity challenge.
And Mustafa, I do want to just stay on the overall economy and how that relates to the budget, because the budget, as always, includes forecast numbers that come from the private sector, a survey. And, you know, we have the Bank of Canada saying yesterday that economic growth is picking up this year. Inflation is still too high, even though it's easing. We may see an interest rate cut in a couple of months in June. You know, what's your sense of the economic outlook for Canada and what it's going to mean for the government's fiscal path?
Well, I think definitely based on the sort of the numbers that we have seen, the monthly numbers, it is going to be stronger than what people expected, you know, a few months ago and at the time of the fall economic statement. And private sector forecasters are going to probably upgrade their forecast, or they have already done that, so that the budget will reflect that. That obviously will provide a little bit more room for the government to play with the fiscal, on the fiscal side. My hope is that they don't use up all that room. I mean, that's what they have been doing in the past, that they, every time they get a sort of a positive surprise on the revenue side, they tend to use that up. And hopefully they're going to be a little bit more careful with the programs that they are going to propose.
All right, lots to watch for next Tuesday. Pedro Antunes and Mustafa Askari, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure,
Andrew. Great. It was a pleasure.
Time now for a look at what happened in politics today. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau hosting his French counterpart in Ottawa, part of Gabriel Attal's first official visit to Canada. The two leaders signing a declaration on wildfire response cooperation, and they renewed a Canada-France climate and environment partnership for another 3 years. Both prime ministers also facing questions on foreign interference targeting both countries, including Canada's last two elections.
It's a huge challenge for us right now. We are seeing clear interference coming, especially from Russia. We are seeing it on the social media. We are seeing it in many places.
Every single constituency election was determined by Canadians, and the election integrity held, and it was free and fair.
The Conservative leader also raising Canada's response to foreign interference. Pierre Poilievre using his speech at a major gathering of small-c Conservatives to criticize the Prime Minister's evidence yesterday at the public inquiry.
The Prime Minister was asked why he didn't do anything about this interference, even though he was warned in briefing notes, is that he doesn't read briefing notes.
And finally, the finance minister is adding to the list of housing measures expected in next Tuesday's federal budget. Chrystia Freeland pledging to give first-time homebuyers a 30-year mortgage amortization, up from a 25-year maximum. This will apply to newly built homes as of August 1st. As well, the withdrawal limit for the federal home buyers plan will rise from $35,000 to $60,000.
These are all real, tangible measures that are going to help more Canadians get into the housing market and buy their first home, while protecting Canadians who already own their own home.
Those pledges come as the Parliamentary Budget Officer says Canada needs to build another 1.3 million homes by 2030 to close the housing gap. That works out to another 181,000 new homes per year above current levels. Now, one of the government's biggest budget promises on housing is the launch of Canada Built, which opens the $55 billion rental construction loan program to provinces and territories. However, those governments need to mimic what British Columbia is doing with its BC Builds program. Here's Michael Serapio in conversation with that province's housing minister, Ravi Kallon.
Minister, good to see you again. Thank you for joining the program.
Yeah, nice to see you. Thanks so much for having me.
Listen, I want to begin with your reaction to the federal government's launch of the Canada Builds program, because it is styled after your own BC Builds program. When you spoke with your federal counterparts, what was it that made your province's program one that Ottawa would want to emulate?
Well, we're pleased to see the federal government go in that direction. We have heard for a long time from our citizens, from our development community, our not-for-profit community, that in order to address the housing crisis, governments must play a more active role in that. And we have been supporting the private sector to continue to increase housing, but there was something missing in the entire plan. And so when we launched it, it was about unlocking government-owned lands, provincially, federally, local government lands, with government financing, tapping the private sector to help build it, and having the not-for-profit continue to operate it. And we just felt, learning from Singapore, Vienna, in Austria, in parts of India, that there are many examples around the world where governments play an active role in housing that helps address housing that is desperately needed. And that's why we went in that direction. And having the federal government come in not only is good for BC, I think it's good for most parts of the province that will see this type of housing being built.
Mm-hmm. Now, you launched your own program back in February. It follows your Homes for People plan that was announced the year before. I'm wondering, when you count up the number of units, how many homes do you think have been fast-tracked already because of BC Builds?
Well, BC Builds just launched. We had our first few sites that we've announced, one in North Vancouver targeting healthcare workers, housing for healthcare workers and folks working on the ports. And we have one other project on the island, which is a partnership with First Nations. It'll be the first project on reserve for this type of housing. So we've only launched a couple of projects, but we have a big lineup of communities coming forward. And so I suspect we're going to have 18 to 20 projects by the end of the year. That is huge for us in the province. And again, this is the type of housing that targets the nurses, the firefighters, the police officers, the workforce that we need to keep our communities continue to move forward. And we're going to continue to build housing at shelter rates, supportive housing, low-income housing, because we know that's needed as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to the Canada Housing and Mortgage Corporation, they say in Vancouver it takes about 26 months or over 2 years for an apartment to kind of go from plan to construction, completed construction. How does BC Builds and Canada Builds, how does that affect the timeline? Does it speed it up?
Yeah, we are already seeing expedited timelines. One of the requirements we have for local governments, if they want to see this type of housing, is that the project be moved to the front of the queue. We have also made significant changes already in the province. We changed the law last year, last fall, that if any project comes within what the community already has in their community plan, that there's no public hearings. So many of our projects won't have to go through public hearings, which saves at least a year, if not more. We have also made changes to other bylaws and local government rules to make sure that all projects go faster. Not only BC Builds projects, but all projects, whether they're government or non-government.
Now, I mentioned CMHC, and back in September, and I know you know this, they said that for affordability to be restored in British Columbia, the province would need to add about 610,000 additional units. Are you making a big chunk in that? Are there plans to tackle that number?
I mean, if anyone thinks that government alone can build that much housing, they're delusional. This is going to require both the private sector to step up, the non-market space to be fully participating, but also governments to be stepping in. And so that's why we're allowing three or four units, fourplexes on single-family lots across the province. We're allowing for six units to be built anywhere where there's frequent transit bus service that comes very frequently. And we're also allowing, with transit-oriented development, any investment we make in transit, it has an understanding that housing needs to come with it. So we've made some major changes. We believe just within the next 5 years, we can get over 200,000 net new housing units being built in the province, net new on top of what we're already doing. And we're fortunate in British Columbia because of changes we've made. We have the highest per capita housing starts in the country right now. And so we believe we're on the right path. Whether we reach the goal or not, it's hard to say. Because there's a lot of market conditions that we can't control. But we certainly are taking advice from the BC Housing Task Force, which gave us a lot of recommendations. But we also look very closely at the Ontario Task Force report, and we're taking the best ideas from both and implementing them in BC.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think the role needs to be for government going forward, though, because, you know, as I don't have to tell you, British Columbia has long had an affordability issue when it comes to housing. We've seen a flurry of housing initiatives in this past year, both from Ottawa and from your own government in Victoria. How much longer do governments need to be providing builders access to low-cost loans, fast-tracking building permits, essentially to make this kind of change permanent? Is this a short-term venture, or is this a permanent role now for government?
Well, I would say a couple things. One, if anyone thinks that you're able to solve the housing crisis without governments being involved, they're not serious about addressing the housing challenge. Governments for two decades have walked away. And if you look at the shortage of affordable housing that we have in BC or across the country, you can pretty much do the math on what would have been built by federal governments and provincial governments if they had continuously been building. And so we in British Columbia believe that the government certainly has a role to invest directly. We are also unlocking the private sector to step up and do what the private sector does, but both need to happen at the same time. Now, to the question about low-cost financing for private sector development, I think in this high-interest environment, when we're dealing with high levels of global inflation, challenges because of labor shortages, we are going to need to be in this space. I don't think this will be a space that governments need to be in permanently going forward, but certainly for the next 3-4 years, I think it's going to be important for us to support the private sector. Even they are having a difficult time with the conditions right now to make projects viable. And so we need to support them to continue to do what they're doing. But we need governments to invest in housing. We need to invest in Indigenous housing on and off reserve. BC is the only province in the country that is doing that. And we want the federal government to play a bigger role.
Minister, always appreciate the time. Thank you for this today.
Thanks for having me, and I look forward to being back again soon.
And that was Michael Serapio's interview with BC Housing Minister Ravi Kallon. That's all for Thursday's edition of Primetime Politics. I'm Andrew Thompson, and for all of us at CPAC, thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.